From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, some of the best food interviews from past shows, including chef and author Patty Hinnich, who shares her unique cultural heritage, and we learn about the bold flavors of Mexican-Jewish cuisine.
Plus, Indian cookbook author and TV host Alamelu Vivaran says you don't have to be super ambitious to make great Indian food.
My way of cooking is get into the kitchen and do whatever you need to do for 45 minutes and get out of the kitchen. I do not like spending whole day in the kitchen, but I love to eat and make a wonderful meal.
And why the author of a new book about ice cream across America decided she had to spend some significant time in Milwaukee.
You can't just go to the grocery store and pick out a pint of frozen custard and have it be the same as frozen custard that you would get at Leon's or Cop's.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For someone who didn't set out on a career in food, Patty Hinnich has certainly gone places. She grew up in Mexico in a Jewish Mexican home, and after moving to the U.S. with her husband, initially pursued a career in international relations.
But life had other things in mind, as we'll hear from her in a moment. Hinnich today is the resident chef of the Mexican Cultural Institute in Washington, D.C. She hosts the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table, and she's even cooked at the White House.
Her 2016 book is a celebration of all the things Mexican food has become in Mexico. Mexican Today features recipes from contemporary Mexican cuisine, incorporating all the various ethnic traditions that have been taken under the Mexican umbrella. We spoke with Patty Hinnich not long after the book came out. Welcome to the show. It is so nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me here, Mitch. Very happy to be in Milwaukee.
Well, I want to start maybe decades and decades ago, because I'm really interested to hear the story of your family's immigration to Mexico, because I think it's one we probably don't think about much in this country.
I think so, too. I think people tend to see Mexico as very unidimensional, just a mix of native Mexican with Spanish, the mix of the intermarriage of old world, new world in very simple ways. But Mexico is much more of a complex mosaic and melting pot than people think. So not only is there the old world mixed from the Spanish conquerors and they had the Mexican colony for 300 years, but there's a French, there's a Italian, there's a Middle Eastern that's very strong, has very strong enclaves in the weirdest of places. I just went to film in Yucatan and found a huge Lebanese community.
Really?
But also, oh yes, gigantic. I know, I was just as surprised, and I'm Mexican, and I've been to Yucatan many times. But also Asian influence, strong. I mean, the Chinese since the 1500s. And just as well, the Jewish settlers, the Jewish people have come to Mexico since the 1500s when they were kicked out of Spain and many decided to jump on those ships. And as marranos, you know, as converts. And since then, there's been an influx in different waves of Jewish people to Mexico. And my grandparents were some of those.
When did your grandparents immigrate to Mexico?
So on my father's side, they were Polish from tiny Polish settles, you know, tiny little towns. They were peasants from Polish land eating potatoes and herring. And they arrived in Mexico before the Mexican Revolution. They were very, very young, so early 1900s. And the wave they came in from was the one that was running away from pogroms. And then on my mother's side, it was later during the Second World War. My grandfather was Czech, very handsome man. He was a little bit of a womanizer, but very, very handsome. And then my grandmother was from Austria. And you know, they found ways to settle in Mexico and to weave the European foods with the Mexican foods in beautiful ways.
And it's hard in some ways to imagine a more different place to go than Mexico, especially compared to Poland, but certainly, you know, what was then Czechoslovakia and Austria. I don't necessarily think of a similar climate, environment, access to the same kinds of foods in Mexico.
I know. It's fascinating. And, you know, they were all trying to get into the U.S., but they couldn't because of several reasons. You know, the wave that came fleeing from the Polish programs, they had closed the Polish quota. And the ones that were trying to come in when the Second World was happening, it was the Jewish quota. There was always some kind of quota. But they found their way to Mexico through the port of Veracruz, and which is a fascinating area in Mexico where a lot of that, you know, intermingling of cultures has happened. And they were fascinated with Mexico because think about my grandparents were Ashkenazi Jews. My grandmother from Austria had a very complex upbringing in terms of food. You know, Austrian food and pastries are divine and complex and beautiful. But my Polish grandparents grew up on boiled potatoes and herring. So they were absolutely fascinated with Mexican ingredients, with the warmth, the colors, the flavors. And so I always say that the Jewish Ashkenazi food in Mexico, there is something as Mexican Jewish food and has existed for centuries, has been blessed and really lucky to have found a place in Mexico, because to eat things such as gefilte fish, you really need an acquired taste. But when you eat gefilte fish that's cooked in a spiked tomato broth with olives and pickled chilies, you don't need an acquired taste.
I was going to ask how the two food traditions inform each other. If I were to go to a Passover Seder or Shabbat dinner in Mexico City, what would it taste like? I mean, you gave us a flavor there with how gefilte fish is different, thank heavens. But how else does Mexican, you know, the more traditional foods of Mexico inform Jewish foods?
You know, it is a fascinating topic. I mean, in terms of Jewish food, but all foods, I think that Mexican cuisine is so strong. It's such a strong mother cuisine. It has such strong pillars that it has the strength and the power to welcome new cuisines and influences and ingredients and sort of bless them and incorporate them into its, you know, like with open arms, transform them, give them the Mexican stamp in a blissful way. And, you know, you have Mexican pasta, you have Mexican sushi, you have Mexican pizza, you have, and in that same way, you have Mexican Jewish food. And their results are, I mean, exquisite. As what Mexican, you know, Mexican gastronomy and cuisine does, it transforms meals or dishes that can be pretty bland into sexy, you know, spicy, seasoned, happy, colorful. So meals in my grandparents' homes were absolutely, you know, irresistible, delicious. Matzo balls, my grandmother used to make matzo ball with a very clear broth, sitting on a bed of steamed wild Mexican mushrooms, steamed with cilantro and jalapeño, just delicious. My other grandmother used to make her chocolate babka with Mexican true cinnamon and Mexican chocolate. So it's just what Mexican gastronomy does, just make it richer.
Do people keep kosher in Mexico?
Some do. Most don't.
I would think with such an emphasis on pork and shellfish, and it would be difficult.
It is difficult. And the Jewish community, you know, as you know, has very different ways to express itself and to grow roots, you know, depending on which country the Jews establish themselves in. In Mexico, it's very ironic because the Jewish community is very divided. You have the Ashkenazi Jews, then you have the Sephardic Jews, but then you have what we call the Arab Jews, which are the Jewish families that have come from Lebanon and from Syria, and they're very divided. You have the Shamis and the Halabis, and intermarriage is considered intermarriage, you know, between an Ashkenazi Jew and a Shami Jew. And they have, you know, very different schools and synagogues and very different ways in terms of cooking.
And at the same time, I gather you grew up like a middle-class kid anywhere might have. I mean, it yes. sounds like a lot of stopping by your favorite street carts with your siblings or friends. What kinds of foods did you gravitate towards besides the, you know, the traditional foods that that might be at a on a holiday plate?
I didn't grow up inside of the Jewish community in Mexico, ironically. I mean, my grandparents were Jewish. We celebrated Shabbat, you know, on Fridays, but that was the only thing we did. I didn't go to Jewish school. I didn't go to a JCC. I didn't at all. So I always felt like I was living between worlds. I was always attracted to, and still I am very attracted to, messy foods. I love messy. I have a sister. I come from a family of four girls, and everybody's into food. One of my sisters, she's a fabulous French-trained pastry chef. And everything she does is, you know, super perfect and tailored and measured. And I am just like, bah! You know, like I want messy. I want to eat it all. So I love hot dogs and hamburgers and pizza and guisados and tacos. And I like messy. That's what I like. And I have three boys, so it helps
me. So that works out well, yes.
Yes.
Well, and so, I mean, so your own story of how you became a chef and kind of a go-to chef at that is pretty interesting as well. I mean, you had already done pretty well for yourself in policy work. What was the spark that got you going towards this other part of your life?
I am a crazy eater. I'm hungry all the time. I love food. The way I experience
well, so am I, but I'm still in radio.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you what I think triggered it. When I moved to the U.S., I got married to my husband. I was 23 years old. I used to feel I was so mature, but now I look at photos and I tell him, what did you do? You took me out of that crib. But anyway, we moved to Texas, and he had to work a lot and travel a lot. We didn't have kids then, and I was writing my thesis, you know, locked in a duplex most of the time. And I was very nostalgic. I was very homesick for Mexico and for my family and for the tastes and the dishes that nurtured me. I really felt, I mean, this sounds depressing, but I was like sad and lonely. You know, I was in Texas and it felt like Mexico, but not. There were Mexicans, but not. There was Spanish, but sounded different. All the restaurants that said Mexican food were not. So I felt like I needed to start doing it for myself and by myself at home. So that's why I started cooking. And once I started cooking, I loved it. And I felt like I needed to continue with the path that I had set myself, you know, towards being a political analyst, being an academic, trying to help the world with some ideas in a small, meaningful way. And so I kept yanking myself back to being a political analyst. But I had some experiences in the food world. I've always loved public radio and public TV. So while I was writing my thesis, I found a way to volunteer in the PBS station in Dallas, and it happened to be a cooking show. And I was so happy doing that. And my husband told me, Patty, you need to go into food. Look how happy you are. And I was like, no, I'm not going to go in the kitchen. I need to work and make a, you know, I come from divorced parents, and my mom has always told me two things. One, never trust any man, even if it's the man you married. And I married a great man. And two, always make a living for yourself. Like, you have to be self, whatever the word is in English.
Self-sustaining.
Self-sustaining. Okay. And so I was like, he wants me to be dependent. He wants me to be, I'm not, I'm going to. So I was very rebellious in that way, but I really always loved cooking, but I stubbornly continued.
I'll show him I'll be a policy analyst.
Exactly, exactly. And he's not going to drag me in the kitchen. But anyway, I did a master's in Latin American studies and then worked in a think tank. And I always had this thing with food. And I did, you know, special programs that focused on chocolate or pastry or bread in the local cooking school. But then one day I was at work and a coworker told me that he was Peruvian, and I had to do a policy research paper explaining the differences between the transition to democracy in Peru and Mexico. serious topics. And I was doing that research, and my coworker, who was Peruvian, said, hey, by the way, you know that Peruvians, we have the best ceviches. And I said, no, you're talking to a Mexican. We have the best ceviches. And he's like, no, but we started making ceviches first. I was like, no, you're wrong. And so instead of researching on the democratic process, I started seriously researching on who got to ceviche first. And after 5 or 6 days, I had written this great article about ceviches in Latin America and the differences between Peruvian and Mexican ceviches. And I came to my boss and I said, I think I'm of no use to you. I think I have to write about food. And I mean, I had struggled for a year not being happy at work.
Well, and I wonder, as you're talking about this, whether there isn't some deep-seated similarity in what you were maybe going to accomplish as a policy analyst and what you are accomplishing in what you do as a food writer.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I wanted to be an academic and help with ideas and something that would help Mexico and help change the world. And, you know, one is an idealist. And now I get emails from somebody telling me, Patty, you know, your fish tacos are a go-to. They save me, you know, on Mondays when my kids need something to eat. And so I feel like I can touch people's lives in a more meaningful way, even if it's with a taco, you know? And I love researching recipes when I get emails or calls about people saying, you know, my grandmother came from Zacatecas and I've never been there, but she used to make these piggy cookies and I don't have a recipe. I'm like, you know, sent on a mission to find those recipes and find ways to connect bridges between communities and generations and people. And I know there's a ton of people doing that. And the more that we do it, I think the richer we are.
There is a section of this latest book that might surprise some people who might be picking up a Mexican cookbook and thinking that they're just leafing through traditional Mexican recipes. There is a section on hot dogs.
Yes.
Which, and you've already said that you love hot dogs, but maybe it gets at something that we probably don't think about much here either. The idea that just as Mexican food might be coming here with some level of Americanization, there are American foods that have become Mexicanized.
I'll tell you, Mitch, you get a lot of complaints from people here in the U.S. that I call them, and they're called Mexican purists, those who say that you can only find fabulous Mexican food south of the border, and to have Mexican authentic food, you have to kneel on the ground and grind that, you know, corn masa for tortillas. And
like Tex-Mex is a swear word.
Yeah, like Tex-Mex is a swear word. And I feel like the more that years and years pass, the more that you see phenomenal Mexican cooking in the U.S., and there's even regional kinds of Mexican food in the U.S. And I always tell people who say, oh, no, this is the bastardization of Mexican food, I always say, have you been to Mexico and have you eaten a hot dog and a hamburger? Because Mexicans have always been obsessed with the U.S. We have these complex love-hate relationship. We want to have the American dream in Mexican soil. We want the Levi's jeans. We want the Hollywood movies. We want the Coca-Cola. You know, it's, but we also are very proud about our Mexicanness. But right next to every amazing taco stand, there's an amazing hot dog stand. We love hot dogs. We love hamburgers. We love pizza. And I'm not making it up for that cookbook. You know, Mexican-style hot dogs and hamburgers and pizza have existed in Mexico for a couple centuries.
Well, Patty Hinich, I feel truly blessed to have spent this time in the studio with you. Thank you so much, and I hope you come back and see us again.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Patty Hinich is the author of the cookbook Mexican Today, New and Rediscovered Recipes for the Contemporary Kitchen. It came out in 2016. She's also the resident chef of the Mexican Cultural Institute in Washington, D.C., and the host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. We spoke with her last year.
A quick break now, and then we'll switch continents to chat with the always delightful Alamelu Vivaron, the Milwaukee author of several healthy Indian cookbooks. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're listening back to some of our favorite food interviews from past shows today. A Milwaukee woman has for years been helping people here and around the country celebrate Indian cuisine in their own kitchens whenever they want.
Alamelu Vairavaran is host of public television's Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu and author of several cookbooks, including The Art of South Indian Cooking and Indian-Inspired Gluten-Free Cooking. She talked with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver last year about her first connections with food as a girl in southern India.
When I was growing up in my parents' home, we had a full-time cook. So there was no opportunity for me to learn or to go into the kitchen to help mom or anything like that. As a child, I was asked to go to good schools, come back, and three scrumptious meals were served every day. So it was a happy childhood memory with great food provided by my family. So I did not have any opportunity to learn any cooking at that time.
What was your favorite food to eat?
I love lunch because even though I went to school and everything, it's not like a sandwich. It's a plate with rice, different vegetables, and some meat like chicken or lamb. And mom will lovingly sit down and serve us lunch. And sometimes when I'm not able to come home because of an exam or something, my mom would send lunch to school in a tiffin box. And I will sit with everyone, and the lunch is basically, in South India, the staple food is rice. And you can make sambar rice, soup rice, yogurt rice. It's amazing. And then with that, she will send me some vegetables. But most of the time, I really came home for lunch. We lived very close to, the school was close to home. So we'll come home for lunch and then go back.
You said rice was a staple of South Indian cooking.
Right.
India is kind of divided between North and South India.
Oh, yeah. India is very diverse. And when you go from state to state, the food is so different and it is awesome. But the major difference is between North and South. In South India, the staple food is rice. And in North India, the staple food is wheat, where they make amazing breads like chapati, puri, aloo paratha, naan, and all that. And in South India, we make very good steamed rice cake called idlis and thin crepes called dosas. And dosas will be filled with vegetables or potatoes and served with chutney. So the staple food here in South India is rice, and there it's wheat. And also, if you want to learn about the vegetarian cooking, South India is the place. You can take any vegetable, cook it so many different ways, eat tasting differently. And in North India too, they eat vegetables and legumes, but it's rich meat-based cuisine. And the spice combination that is used between North and South is also different. In Northern India, most of the dishes are cooked with garam masala, and it's kind of a same kind of cloves, cardamom and cinnamon like that. But in South India, when you want to make vegetable dishes, you have different kinds of spice blends called sambar powder, rasam powder, chutney powder. So when you are cooking vegetables, it doesn't taste the same. Each one has its own unique texture, flavor. And it's really wonderful.
So in the United States, in Indian restaurants, do they tend to be North Indian or South Indian?
Yeah, in the United States, mostly it's North Indian restaurants. However, if you go to New York or California, you will find a good South Indian restaurant. I know in Milwaukee, sometimes in the weekend brunch, they will say they serve South Indian brunch, but really it's mostly North Indian restaurants here.
And so you've created a career about South Indian food, South Indian cooking. You have a show on PBS.
Right.
At what point did you actually start to cook? How did that happen?
Okay. I had to learn cooking in a hurry. As I told you, when I was a child growing up in India, never went into the kitchen. But when I got married and came here, I was asking my husband, where is our cook? He said, you're looking at us. So what happened was, truly, I have seen all the spices and spice blends in the kitchen, but never knew how to use them. So I had to learn cooking in a hurry. And in New York, my uncle had a chef in his home, just like in India. So my aunt said, leave Alamelo here. We will teach her the basics and how to turn the stove on and off carefully. So that's how my cooking really started. And then I think out of necessity, they say necessity is the mother of invention. And I was craving for this wonderful comfort food and did not have any idea how to prepare it. So anytime I go to India or to New York to see that chef, I would have a notebook and a pen and I'll start writing down the recipes. Of course, with trial and error. Sometimes it's total disaster in the kitchen, but then I persisted and started cooking. And when I started cooking and making food for me and my husband, he would say, Alamelo, you're becoming a good cook. So I started believing, oh, maybe I am a good cook. So that's how it all started.
That's wonderful. Do you have a memory of a particularly tough time in the kitchen, or
yes.
What was, yes, you do?
Yes, I do. I remember when I was making my Madras coffee, which is like cappuccino or latte, for my husband, and I was making that for him instead of sugar. I put the instant coffee and sugar and brought it to my husband. He took one sip and spit it out, and he said, Alamelo, what did you put in? So I took him to the kitchen, and what we found out was, instead of sugar, I had put a baking soda. And then I told him, well, when I put the sugar in the milk, it was boiling over and foaming. I did not even have to transfer back and forth. Milk here is magic, I said.
That is so funny. That's really funny. So you started slowly but surely getting used to the kitchen.
Yeah.
What was the first thing that you were able to cook that you felt really confident about?
Okay. I think what I did was I started making very simple meals. Even today, I make only simple. Simple meals are delicious. You don't have to stay in the kitchen for hours to create a wonderful, wholesome meal. So I do cook the vegetables and all that. So I started enjoying cooking on a daily basis. And my way of cooking is get into the kitchen and do whatever you need to do for 45 minutes and get out of the kitchen. I do not like spending whole day in the kitchen, but I love to eat and make a wonderful meal.
How did cooking complement other aspects of your personality?
Oh, I love people. I really do love people. See, in India, when I was growing up, I had two brothers, two sisters, and we had in my parents' home, we had a cook, a driver, gardener, maids. So I was always surrounded by people. And when I came to America, my husband will go to work and I'll be sitting alone in the apartment. And it was not very easy adjustment, and I really needed to reach out. So the cooking and the food, my husband will invite his friends or his professors in the beginning to our home. And when they say, this is very good, I really like it, and they started asking me for recipes and all that, I really loved it. So people, I love people and I love food.
So you've made it kind of a mission to help people feel confident in cooking Indian food.
Actually, I never thought of the cookbook right away. I went to UWM and I earned my degree in health information management. But When I was going to school, I also had two children, a daughter and a son, in Whitefish Bay schools. And the Whitefish Bay schools will call me and say, today we have a cultural day. Will you come and do some cooking? And I will say, oh, really? You want me to? And then I will brave myself. I'll take my skillet and go and do something. And the students will come and say, oh, this is awesome. I really like it. How do you do it? And all of a sudden, they covered it on the newspaper, on television, and I really started believing, like, oh, maybe I can do this. You know, it was really fun.
And you have a special affinity for children and seniors, right?
Yes, very, very much.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. Recently, I mean, last year, it was a nutritional month in, nutritional month is in March every year. And Whitefish Bay Schools invited me to come and do a program. And I asked them, what is the age group, which grade I'm going to? They said, kindergarten, your audience is 5 years old. And I said, oh, really? That must be fun. And I wasn't afraid because over the years, I have fed kids, teens, adults, seniors over the years. And I know how much they like it. So what I did was I made a multicolored pepper rice dish and took it to school. And they had two sections of the kindergartners in one classroom. And when I went there, the kids, they were all very cute five-year-olds. And they said, oh gosh, it smells so good. What did you bring? I said, no cookies, no brownies, and no cakes. And I made a rice dish. And they were so rice dish. And then, you know, I did take all the vegetables that I used in the rice. I put it in a platter and asked them to name the vegetables. And if they did not know, I told them what kind of, I took a multicolored peppers, onions, tomatoes, and cilantro. And then we gave the food for tasting, right? And you should have seen these kids when they were given this rice dish in a plate. They ate and they raised their hand and they wanted seconds and thirds. And one kid wanted to take that rice dish to his mother. And another one said, if I have a birthday, can you come and teach us all how to cook? Aww. So it was truly an amazing experience. Another one, this is 5-year-old, looked at my cookbook and said, how did you put all these things to a book? What did you do? It blew my mind off. And I said, oh, you know, you need to work on it and you put this together. So it was really fun. So I have done programs from 5-year-olds to 90 years old.
So you come into contact with people who probably have never had Indian food before.
Yes, uh-huh.
or vegetarian.
Yes,
vegetable.
Definitely. Well, I have done programs for some Chamber of Commerce and they invite me. I'm also a wellness presenter. So I go into the companies for lunch and learn and things like that. And when I do that, people will say, gee, gosh, I don't know if I like spices and all that. I'll say, oh, really? And I give them an orientation to spices and legumes, and right in front of them, I will cook a rice dish or a vegetable dish, and they will have a sample. And then they will say, oh, I read about turmeric, I read about cumin, and they said it's like food and medicine all in one, and I see how you put the spices together, and it's really not hot. I really want to learn how to prepare these dishes. So it's a magical experience.
Have you had a situation where you've started with someone who has never even tasted the food before, and then they get so into it that they want to learn to cook it, and eventually you teach them how to cook?
Yes. I remember when I was doing one program, I was asked to come and do a team building event. At that time, this person said, I don't like spicy food, and I don't know if my stomach can take it. I had a horrible experience. I said, said, oh, really? What happened to you? I asked him. And he said, well, last night I ate a pepperoni pizza, he said. And that was spicy. And I said, look here. What you ate probably is fat and salt. So it's not the spices. But just keep an open mind. Let's see where it takes you. And then when he was into the class doing something, he said, I really want to learn how to eat more vegetables. So it was wonderful.
So you have multiple books, but you've kind of geared them about healthy cooking.
Yeah.
And so in one of your books, in your introduction, you wrote that you should approach South Indian cooking with an attitude of relaxation and enjoyment.
Yeah.
And not allow yourself to worry about exact measurements or the lack of certain ingredients.
Uh-huh.
And you said your dishes will be delicious and family and guests will be delighted with your efforts.
Yes.
Have you found that that rings
that's
true?
That's exactly. It's from my own learning experience. I did not even know how to use those spices. And you just have to have an open mind and you must have a willing to learn. It's just like anything else, music instrument, driving a car. If you are scared and don't want to do it, you will never learn. And for me, it is also a necessity that I had to learn. So I kept an open mind and I said, oh, the cook in India made this wonderful cauliflower soup. I wonder how to make that. And my mind went on to go learn how to make those dish. So it's an attitude and willing to learn will help anyone master anything in this world.
Alamelu Vaivaran, thank you so much for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Alamelu Vaivaran is the host of the public television show Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu. She's the author of several cookbooks as well, including The Art of South Indian Cooking and Healthy South Indian Cooking. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver last year.
Another break, and then we travel to the land of the frozen dairy dessert for a conversation about the state of American ice cream. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We've had a couple of segments on frozen custard this summer on Lake Effect, an interview with the manager of the Babcock Hall Dairy Plant at UW-Madison, and an installment of Bubbler Talk on frozen custard culture.
But for all the time we've spent researching and producing content about creamy frozen dairy desserts, we are put to shame by the amount of time that writer Amy Ettinger has spent. Ettinger went in search of the state of ice cream in the 21st century.
The result is the new book, Sweet Spot, An Ice Cream Binge Across America, and it included a not always pleasant visit to Milwaukee, as we'll hear about. She joined us on the line in June from California. Amy Ettinger, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what fed your own interest in ice cream?
I have always eaten and loved ice cream. I have no memories as a kid of not having it. I can't remember the first time I tried it. I must have had it as a baby. And when I noticed all these artisanal shops opening all over the country, I decided, you know, the journalist in me said, I need to know what's going on here. We've always loved ice cream in this country, but this seems like we're in a boom. So I went out and I started talking to the people who are making it.
Not everyone who has this visceral connection to ice cream sets out to make their own, or certainly not to the degree that you have. Can you explain the significance of the ice cream school at Penn State?
Yes. So the Penn State has had a school there for about 150 years. It's a great dairy community in that part of the country. And in the wintertime, people would send their kids to ice cream making school at Penn State to learn how to make ice cream. So I went out there. There's still a famous short course that is still in the wintertime. I went out. There had been just been a blizzard. It was freezing cold. And I learned the tips and the techniques to making good ice cream. And it's different than some of the recipe books that are out there. They don't talk about some of the formulas. When you're at a school like that, they talk about formulas instead of recipes and ratios and how to get that base
perfectly mixed. And what you need to do, I think, as a home chef, I suffer from having a lot of impatience. But what I learned out there, besides, you know, the fact that you need certain things in your ice cream base to make it really work, is you really need to be patient. You need to set your ice cream base in the refrigerator overnight, and then you need to churn it through an ice cream maker, and then you need to be patient and let it freeze. So it was really a test of my resolve in many ways to go through that process. But it's really revolutionized the way I make ice cream. And so for my daughter, you know, I have a daughter, her 8-year-old birthday party, we had an ice cream social, and I served out, you know, 6 or 7 different flavors that I had created. And it's really fun. It's a way of bringing family and friends into my house and an excuse to have a fun afternoon.
Now, do your daughter and her friends appreciate the savory flavors?
No. Although, so one of the flavors, one of the extremely extreme flavors that I tried in my book was mealworm ice cream. And I felt like I needed to try it because it's come up on the menu of different ice cream shops across the country. And it sells out before the health department can get in there and shut it down. That's really the key, right? So I said, I really need to try this. And I was horrified at the idea of actually doing it. But my daughter, when she found out we were going to have toffee-covered mealworm ice cream, was absolutely ecstatic. She was running through the house screaming at the top of her lungs about it. And what it really brought home for me was some of these ideas that we have about food and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable really is ingrained in us in childhood. I mean, people in other countries eat bugs. They eat bugs very regularly, not just in desserts, but in their food. But we don't think of that as a food source. I at least do not think of that as a food source. But it really did bring home, the things that we think of as yucky or delicious, they get set in our brains really early on in our life.
All right, so how was the mealworm ice cream?
It was not good. I had read up about it. I had thought, it's really not going to be as bad as I think it's going to be. These are a very high protein, you know.
Sometimes things just live up to expectations, though.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't even the flavor, but there was a crunch that should not be in ice cream, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
Now, one of the issues that you write a lot about is the mix with which most ice cream shops start their ice cream, and the issue of whether you can make your own mix. So what is at stake in this question for you?
I had this idea in my brain when I was beginning the research of this book that there were chefs who were working in the back of these ice cream shops mixing milk, cream, sugar, and eggs on a stovetop the way that I do at home. This is how I thought ice cream was made at artisanal or homemade ice cream shops.
It's a very romantic notion.
It is. I realize that. And the truth of the matter is there are very strict regulations about pasteurization in this country. Ice cream mix has to be pasteurized and it has to be put through a pasteurizer. And if you have a pasteurizer on site, which is very, very rare at ice cream shops across the country, it's very difficult to get the proper permitting for it. And you will get constantly inspected by the health department. So a lot of places don't want to do it. It can be a headache. So a lot of shops rely on pre-made mixes, and then it becomes up to an artisanal ice cream maker to become unique within the confines of this prepackaged ingredient.
Sure.
How do you stand out from the crowd? How do you make the flavors really be interesting, be different from what's being sold down the street, and to get enough marketing and interest in your shop? And I had to rethink the idea of being creative and being really unique with flavors.
Now, you mentioned the idea of the proprietary formula, and that is something that is kind of part and parcel of the way the frozen custard stands, or at least many of them in Milwaukee operate. You came to Milwaukee because this is frozen custard ground zero. And right off the bat, let me ask you, do you separate it? I know there are technical descriptions of what makes frozen custard, what makes ice cream, what makes, you know, frozen dairy dessert or what have you. In your mind, do you separate frozen custard from ice cream, or does this all go kind of under one umbrella? You know, we look for the same kind of experience.
I think it's different. It is the same experience, but it's, in my view, a more special experience, because you really have to go to the frozen custard stand to enjoy the frozen custard. You can't just go to the grocery store and pick out a pint of frozen custard and have it be the same as frozen custard that you would get at Leon's or Kopp's. It's not going to be the same. And there's also a difference in the amount of egg that's used. There's a different standard for the custard versus the ice cream. So it's a very, I think of it sort of as a denser, more delicious cousin to ice cream. That's how I like to think of it.
And at the same time, you didn't have qualms about including frozen custard in a book that is ostensibly about ice cream.
That's true. I mean, they are related. And I think I make it clear that I find it to be different, but, you know, in the same spectrum as ice cream.
So one of the things that you ask is a question that I think a lot of people here, myself included, have tried to get to the heart of, and with really only limited success. Why is Milwaukee the center of the frozen custard universe?
I found a couple of very interesting theories and ideas about why Milwaukee is you know, the epicenter, where the place you have to go to.
It's only ever theories, too.
There is the fact that there is the tradition of the ice harvesting in Milwaukee. And so there was always, I think, a strong history of ice cream making and frozen desserts in Milwaukee because of the proximity to the lake. And at the same time, Milwaukee is very close to where frozen custard was born. It was really showcased in Chicago at the World Fair there. So it makes sense that from, you know, that Chicago area, and then you've got the wonderful Wisconsin milk and cream, that you would get this specialty, this really regional specialty.
Did you come out of here with a sense for why it has really not proliferated beyond Wisconsin? Why, you know, you can get frozen custard in other places, but it's not really the same?
Yes. I think that the machines, those big, large machines that were, you know, they call the Easy Way from the 1950s, there aren't that many machines like that anymore. Thomas Carvel sold them out in the Midwest in the 40s and 50s, and they're not made anymore. You can't find them anymore. And so some places will call themselves frozen custard places, and they will use the frozen custard base that they will get from a Wisconsin supplier, but they will put it through a soft serve machine. And it's not the same, because one of the qualities of the frozen custard is the denseness of it, the lack of what they call in the ice cream business overrun. Overrun is when you pump the air into it and you get sort of, sometimes you get really fluffy ice cream if you get a lot of air in there. And custard is the opposite. You don't have a lot of air in there. It's extraordinarily dense. And I think the machines really come into play. There's also the expertise. A lot of the custard makers are there, and they have settled there, and they've kept the business in the family in Milwaukee. So it's not like their children are moving to other parts of the world and opening frozen custard shops there.
We can't have this conversation without pointing out the really unfortunate thing that happened to you. It was not an altogether positive visit to Milwaukee for you.
I ran into some trouble in Milwaukee. Let's just put it that way. And it was interesting, because I didn't expect to be carjacked in Milwaukee in broad daylight in a very nice part of town. So It was shocking. It was absolutely shocking when it happened. But I will say that there were some good Samaritans out there that absolutely took me under their wings and helped me out in a very difficult moment for me. So when I think of my time in Milwaukee and I think of the carjacking, I definitely think of the kind of the people who came to my aid, the people who found my wallet and sent it back to me, or the people who found my phone and turned it into the police, you know, the police department. So it was a very, very mixed experience.
I think folks who read this book here will be saddened to see that the recipe that you include is called the Never Going Back to Milwaukee Butter Pecan Custard. Understandable, though.
I might have to revise that because I was looking at the Cops flavor forecast the other day. It was National Chocolate Ice Cream Day, and they had, of course, their chocolate frozen custard on the menu. And I thought, oh, maybe I can reconsider this because you really can't get that anywhere else.
Well, and it sounds like frozen custard actually played a role in bringing things back to normal for you after the carjacking took place.
I went out and had frozen custard. I really did. And I was I had read that eating ice cream in World War II became this remedy for combat fatigue. They would literally serve it to the troops or for people who were sort of suffering from PTSD. And it reminded me of why I started writing this book to begin with, this sense of childhood comfort that I had from ice cream. So it was kind of a fascinating moment in that regard.
At the end of this whole experience, as you learned about the various facets of the ice cream making business and the ice cream consumption business, if you will, and your own connection to it, can you separate out the flavor of the ice cream, the actual tasting experience, from the emotional connection?
It's difficult. I think that I have become, as I write in my book, a bit of an ice cream snob in the sense that I am now seeking out these very original flavors, or at least ice cream that's created in a really original way. I went to Seattle and had this ice cream that was made from Jersey cows, and I went to Petaluma, California, and I had ice cream that was made from water buffalo milk. So there is this tasting that happens, this delight that happens on one level for me when I'm having something that's different and interesting. On the other hand, you know, when friends take me out to the local ice cream shop and they're buying me a scoop of ice cream and our kids are playing in the park together, I'm transported back to those family memories of camaraderie and happiness. And I don't care how the ice cream has been made that I'm eating. I am just having an experience that I'm enjoying. So I think that both things are possible. It's possible to really go out and seek these original, very wonderful flavors. And it's also possible to be open to having these nostalgic experiences with whatever is being put in front of you.
Well, Amy Ettinger, it's a delightful read. And thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Amy Ettinger's new book is called Sweet Spot, An Ice Cream Binge Across America. It came out in June. Ettinger has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other publications. We reached her at her home in California.
You can find our other recent features on frozen custard at WUWM.com.
Your love is better than ice cream, better than anything else that I.
And that is Friday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie and I produce the show each day, along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver, and the amazing efforts from our interns, who we sadly say goodbye to today. Katie Kokel and Eden Herbert return to Missouri and Pittsburgh, respectively, but hopefully they will not leave the radio world.
Thanks so much to both of you for your great work and great company this summer. And thank you for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Right now it's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.